huge collective effort and sacrifice, which is exactly what we need to solve the climate crisis. That historical precedent is World War II. Finally, fun stuff. Methane-eating bacteria, a bacteria that a California company is using to both chow down on emissions and make textiles at the same time.
Yum, yum. Tune in to Extinction Rebellion Radio Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. WBAI.
The previous program was the WBAI Evening News, heard daily at 6 p.m. Stay tuned for Extinction Rebellion coming up. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM, and WBAI.org online.
You're listening to Extinction Rebellion Radio on WBAI.
Welcome to the Rebellion. This is Extinction Rebellion Radio with Matthew Kearney and Elise Lane. Extinction Rebellion is a climate activism group with no hierarchy. With nonviolent civil disobedience, we pressure for a rapid transition away from fossil fuels to zero emissions to stop the extinction of animals, plants, and yes, maybe even humanity. We are on WBAI Radio. WBAI is having its annual membership drive, and we do not exist as a program in this format without WBAI Radio. We ask you please to support WBAI if you possibly can. The way to do it is to go to WBAI.org and click on ways to donate. Now, this is listener supported radio. It operates on a shoestring budget. They use every dollar you give them. If you give them $100, they will use it and put it to excellent use. But $25 is all it takes to be a member for the year. With $25, you get an annual membership to WBAI, and you can give any amount that you are able to give. They will surely use it.
It sure will. So the Amazon basin might now be making our climate crisis a lot worse. That's the conclusion reached by authors of Carbon and Beyond, the Biogeochemistry of Climate in a Rapidly Changing Amazon. And this scientific study is the most comprehensive assessment to date of the Amazon basin's influence on global heating. So how is the Amazon making our climate crisis worse? Well, as a result of all those fires and the result of the drought and land clearing, the Amazon basin is being transformed into a forest that releases more heat-trapping gases than it stores in its plants and soil. Mm. And what this means is that we can no longer count on this crucial rainforest to help offset greenhouse gas emissions from human activities. Now, the 30 scientists who conducted the research for this study tell us that we should expect the Amazon's contribution to global heating to grow. Their work buttresses previous studies in which some scientists concluded that as soon as 2035, that's only 14 years from now, people, the Amazon will flip from a carbon sink to a carbon source, as in a source of carbon emissions, an emitter of carbon.
Sheesh, we're in trouble.
And we're in deep trouble. You can find this new study in the science journal Frontiers in Forests and Global Change. You know, Matt, when I think about how much of this tragedy is driven by the illegal land seizures on reserves and indigenous territories in Brazil's Amazon, and I'm speaking specifically right now of deforestation for illegal cattle farming, which is up 60% since 2012. Mm-hmm. When I think of this tragedy, it really reminds me of the study published in 2019 that addressed the climate impact of colonization in North and South America. You might have heard of it. The title of the study is Earth System Impacts of the European Arrival and Great Dying in the Americas after 1492. Typical academic title. That study had such an impact that it even made mainstream headlines. Now, anyway, the scientists who conducted the study postulated that, quote, the great dying of the indigenous peoples of the Americas led to the abandonment of enough cleared land that the resulting terrestrial carbon uptake had a detectable impact on both atmospheric CO2 and global surface air temperatures, end quote.
According to the study, Christopher Columbus kicked off European colonization when he landed in 1492. 55 million indigenous people across the Americas died over the next century through events like genocide and disease. That removed millions of carbon producers from the equation and left an estimated 56 million hectares of land vacant.
So the deaths of 56 million of the estimated 60 million inhabitants of North and South America between 1492 and 1600 were so impactful to the environment that they led to what is known as the Little Ice Age, which was a time when temperatures across the Northern Hemisphere might have fallen more than 1 degree Celsius below their average in the mid-20th century. Here we are faced with another moment when the colonization of South America, that is the violent plunder we are witnessing now of indigenous peoples' lands in the Amazon basin, plunder that includes the murder of indigenous land defenders. Colonization is once again creating a climate crisis. Only this time, it is creating a crisis that is warming Earth. And that is a crisis we might not ultimately survive. Now, in other news, Rystad Energy Report, this is an energy newsletter. You all should sign up for these things. You got to keep up with what they're doing. Rystad Energy reports that the oil and gas demand recovery supported by vaccination efforts and OPEC plus supply cuts is proving this year to be good for drilling activities. Indeed, onshore drilling activity is expected to increase by 12% from 46,000 wells drilled in 2020 to about 51,700 wells in 2021. Rystad Energy goes on to say that this recovery of drilling activity is poised to propel offshore drilling activity beyond pre-pandemic levels during the next 2 years, with 2022 expected to be a year of further growth. The Amazon, you know, won't be able to offset the emissions that this drilling will inevitably produce. The White House last week issued a statement that said National Climate Advisor Gina McCarthy and fossil fuel industry executives met and discussed, quote unquote, shared priorities on cutting emissions and creating new creating new union jobs. McCarthy, quote, made clear that the administration is not fighting the oil and gas sector, but fighting to create union jobs, deploy emission reduction technologies, strengthen American manufacturing, and fuel the American economy, end quote. Strengthening American manufacturing. Fuel the American economy. If you don't hear in those phrases continued growth and therefore continued greenhouse gas emissions, then you're absolutely fooling yourself.
That press release you just quoted reads like propaganda.
It's total propaganda. It's greenwashing propaganda. Now, according to World Oil, the World Oil Energy Newsletter, the meeting included executives from three industry trade groups and 10 oil companies, ExxonMobil Corporation, BP, ConocoPhillips, Royal Dutch Shell, Chevron Corporation and Devon Energy Corporation, all of whom presumably cheered the U.S. return. Sorry, I have to laugh at that. They cheered the U.S. return to the Paris Agreement and urged greater government support of carbon capture and hydrogen technology.
That was Ailes. The cheered, right? You're quoting from the text.
From World Oil Energy Newsletter. That's apparently what two people familiar with the Zoom meeting told World Oil. And by the way, the White House is keeping secret the actual meeting participants. You really have to wonder why.
Well, I'm not so sure I have to wonder why. It's pretty clear why. They figure Extinction Rebellion will organize protests against them. They figure climate-conscious customers will stop buying their product, maybe. They figure people of goodwill who care about social justice will object and say so. If they're meeting in secret, they don't want the public to know who they are because they know what they're doing is unpopular. Pardon the interjection. I just had to put that in there.
You know, I don't mind the interjection, Matt. You accepted my invitation. Basically for an interjection. And you're absolutely right. And this is the thing. Almost every single one of these oil companies is in Cancer Alley, which we talked about 2 weeks back. Cancer Alley is located in Louisiana. For those of you who don't know, it's along an 85-mile stretch of the lower Mississippi River. It is a toxic corridor. And these industries are not held to account for the sickness and the disease and death they are creating in the communities along that corridor, and primarily Black communities and communities of color. Now, Biden mentioned Cancer Alley when he signed his environmental executive orders this past January. And I can bet your bottom dollar, Cancer Alley never came up with this meeting between climate advisor McCarthy and the fossil fuel executives. I bet environmental justice never came up. Anyway, World Oil writes that almost all of the executives in the virtual session made a pitch for putting a price on carbon dioxide emissions. A policy shift, they said, could trigger greater investment in emission reducing technology while fostering more certainty for energy companies. In other words, they made a pitch for continuing to emit carbon, regardless of global heating, which they knew about for decades, regardless of Cancer Alley, which they also knew about for decades. Let's pause for a moment. You're listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio, hosted by Elise Lane and Matthew Kearney. And for today's show, you are being treated to climate news, the good, the bad, the ugly. That's one of my favorite movies, the Clint Eastwood movies. But it's climate news, and which you don't really get regularly on mainstream media as a matter of policy. However, you do get climate news and analysis on WBAI as a matter of policy, as well as a wealth of other wonderful content supported by listeners like you. Now, as you know, we're in the midst of our membership drive. And so for just $25, not only can you become a full member of WBAI, but you can also keep alive radio programming that is the voice of the people. As I said last time, it's not the voice of corporate sponsors. It's not the voice of fossil fuel industries. You won't hear a brought to you by Chevron break. No, this is a station that is the voice of the people, your voice. So pledge now. Go to WBAI.org, click on ways to donate, and donate $25. Become a member. These are tough times, yes. So donate as much as you can afford and support the people's voice. So I mentioned Chevron a moment ago. On February 9th, 2021, just last month, the petrol giant spilled an estimated 600 gallons of oil into the San Francisco Bay. You might not have heard about this spill, though the press here reported on it initially. There have been no follow-up reports, none that I've seen anyway. It's almost like it didn't even happen. Now, according to The Guardian, the February 9th spill at the Chevron Wharf, quote, poured unabated for nearly 2 hours on Tuesday, casting a brownish sheen across the waters of the northeastern part of the bay where harbor seals haul out, migratory birds skim the water, and residents live and recreate, end quote. Now, I can personally attest to that. I live in Richmond, California, just blocks away, actually, from the Chevron refinery, which is the largest and oldest major oil refinery on the West Coast. It covers 2,900 acres, has 5,000 miles of pipelines and hundreds of large tanks that can hold up to 15 million barrels of crude, gasoline, jet fuel, diesel, lube, oil, wax, and other chemicals produced by the refinery. It churns out 45,000 barrels of crude oil a day. Now, on the day of the spill, a neighbor had noticed the sheen on the bay and approached Chevron workers at the wharf about it. And though the water clearly didn't look right, and though people throughout my neighborhood could smell the petrol in the air, and though people were reporting the problem to Chevron, the workers claimed they were not aware of anything amiss. You know, hours of spilling had passed, and yet they said they were not aware of anything amiss. In its report, the Guardian notes that the Richmond refinery is, quote, one of California's largest polluters, casting toxins into the sky and sea even during normal operations. And this is true. You know, sometimes I just don't go outside because the air is so bad. State records show the refinery released nearly the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions in 2018 that it did a decade prior, end quote.
As you can imagine, the refinery is an environmental justice nightmare. And this information about not being able to go outside because the air is so bad, that's amazing to me. I'm privileged. I never lived in such a place. I never had that level of air problem as far as I knew.
Yeah, something else.
As The Guardian points out, quote, roughly 80% of Richmond's residents are people of color. Nearly one-fifth of families fall near the poverty line. Studies have shown higher rates of cancer than in other parts of the county. That's Contra Costa County, so just local. And roughly 27% of children in the city have asthma. That's nearly double the rate that do countywide, end quote. Somehow, I doubt Gina McCarthy and fossil fuel industry executives discussed as part of their shared priorities, cutting the cancer and asthma rates suffered by frontline communities like Richmond. When the Chevron executive spoke, quite possibly that Richmond oil spill never came up.
Yeah, that would have been a White House statement release if it had.
Extinction Rebellion has been calling for a fast transition to a zero-emission society. We were founded on that demand. Partly that's strategic. We won't get the politicians to agree to do it in, say, 10 years if we don't push for doing it in 5 years. And we won't actually pull it off in 10 years unless we try to do it in 5. But the more important reason we say that is because the science says that. Climate scientists are crystal clear. If we are still emitting greenhouse gases 10 years from now, we're looking at permanent environmental catastrophe, redrawing global coastlines, rendering huge areas of the planet uninhabitable, triggering by far the largest refugee migration in human history. Now, not all of that happens at the mark 10 years from now, but it is virtually guaranteed to happen eventually if we don't get this transition done in the very near future. So Extinction Rebellion wants to shut down fossil fuel production and fossil fuel use rapidly. That's what we're calling for, not a leisurely wind down of several decades while we write press releases about shared priorities and incentivizing green energy. And all the while, we continue to burn millions of barrels of oil and continue to spew millions of tons of carbon into the air and building just a few turbines here and there. No. We need a total and rapid revision of how we get energy.
You know, Matt, we actually needed a total and rapid revision back when Al Gore was just a lowly congressman.
So we're late, and that means we have to act even bolder than we had than we would have had to do back when Al Gore was just a lowly congressman. So we're behind, and we better get going. Now, before you dismiss where we're going with all this and think, well, there's no way in hell anything like that could happen. They're just a bunch of loonies. Stay with us and consider that modern society did a massive economic transition with a massive societal mobilization in less than 5 years, from 1940 to 1945, World War II. Most people in all the industrialized nations of the world on both sides of that war had their lives severely disrupted and had to devote large portions of their working hours to the war effort in one form or another. It was, of course, the men on the front lines and in the naval ships and flying the airplanes who were risking their lives. But it was everybody on the home front, living without plastic, living without rubber, rationing their food products, rationing their medicine in some cases, people who hadn't been working before entering the labor force into war production jobs or into essential jobs that replaced those who went into the military. My grandmother did that. She worked as a local pharmacist after the pharmacist went off to war. People spending all their spare money on war bonds. Think about that. All the spare money you get, you buy war bonds. People delaying having children. Just huge sacrifices. And it all happened for at least two really big reasons. One, of course, because people were invested in the cause. And they believed that others were too. They wanted to win the war. But they also believed that everybody else was doing work to try to win the war. So it was like a social obligation. It's a little bit like my own theory of collective action. It's not just a pet theory of mine. I've published it. I call it escalating mutual obligation, a moral obligation that gets more intense when others are pursuing it and making sacrifices at the same time you are. Because then you feel like you have to keep on maxing out your own commitment. It's a commitment to other people as well as to the cause. Escalating mutual obligation is hard to trigger, but once it gets triggered, it locks in very high levels of effort. It got triggered during World War II. Now, the second big reason, there's maybe more than two, but at least the second big reason that World War II's huge collective effort was pulled off is people believed it was temporary. The war wouldn't last forever. They could accept sacrifices temporarily. When they were in it, they didn't know exactly how long it would be, but they didn't think it would be for the rest of their lives. They also knew that their lives would be different afterwards.
Yeah, and they also believed that they would win.
Mm-hmm. They did. The climate crisis is a lot like that, except we don't know if we're going to win. Like with the war, the transition would be temporary as green energy comes online at scale, except we, and I guess I mean collective humanity overall, we don't all have a sense of urgent shared purpose. The United States did, then the United Kingdom did, and the Soviet Union did on the Allied side. And on the Axis side, the Japanese did, and the Germans did, and the Italians did. We don't have that level of shared purpose and collective buy-in today yet. I'm talking so much about the World War II mobilization to try to show that we can learn from this experience. We can learn that it is possible to do mass popular sacrifice and transform the economy in 5 years. It has been done. Perhaps, maybe, just maybe, it can be done again. This example teaches us that when there's a shared moral purpose with very widespread buy-in, with governmental leadership and a certain governmental pressure on the citizens to comply with the restrictions that are necessary, then society can make huge changes fast.
Not just the citizens, Matt. The government also pressured the corporations to comply, to become something aligned with that shared purpose. That's important to keep in mind.
Yes, that outlandish idea that government should govern the corporations in the collective interest of society instead of corporations governing the government.
Crazy, huh?
Oh, crazy. Now, I'm hoping to devote a future show or shows to what changes we would have to make to actually pull this off. I'm not seeing too many people writing or speaking about that, like actually designing a solution. No time to do it all today. But I really want to put that together and try to offer a way out of this crisis. It would be difficult, certainly, but not impossible. Now you're listening to WBAI. Our show is Extinction Rebellion Radio. Alix Lane and Matthew Kearney here. And WBAI is in its annual membership drive. We encourage you to go to WBAI.org. You can click on ways to donate. $25 is the threshold for getting you an annual membership in WBAI. Listener supported radio like this is a small but crucial part of the American media landscape. This kind of programming is unlikely to be heard anywhere else. So please do support WBAI to the extent that you can. There is a lot of bad news about the climate. Sometimes it feels like all of the news relevant to climate is bad. And certainly the overall picture is bleak. But we sometimes do find some good news. In the spirit of regenerative culture, we want to do an occasional segment on the show specifically devoted to good news. So this inaugural segment of good news starts with a bit of a bad news context, but then it does get to something positive. Our sources are an NPR report and the Mango Materials Company website. Thank you to Nancy Pendergast for doing the research behind this segment. Plastic is a polymer, a long chain molecule made of identical units. Some polymers with natural sources, like silk from a silkworm, can break down naturally in a few weeks or a few months. Plastic comes from petroleum, and we think some variations of plastic take 400 years to break down. In fact, I was even taught in school, although this may not be the latest science, but I remember being taught that some plastic never decomposes. It will last forever if it's not recycled. Now, Mango Materials is a company that manufactures a biopolymer plastic alternative from bacteria. They specifically chose a bacteria that eats methane because methane is a greenhouse gas that contributes to the climate crisis. This methane-eating bacteria is cultivated in a fermenter in Redwood City, California, in between two sewage tanks. After the bacteria consumes the bacteria turns the methane into a natural polymer. So methane is the food, and a natural polymer is the waste product. You can harvest this polymer and turn it into a pellet. The pellet can be turned into a textile and be used as a polyester alternative. So you can make clothes out of it, or maybe bed sheets, or a child's toy, or a lot of things that we use textiles for. It can even maybe be sent into outer space. NASA has been working on using 3D printer grade pellets for filaments. The company that does this, Mango Materials, was started by a couple of entrepreneurs who happened to be women and who named their company after their favorite fruit. One of the most common questions about biodegradable polymers made into a textile is, will it biodegrade when I am wearing it or when I put it in my dresser? The answer is no. It is a stable polymer which needs microbes and time. Like months immersed in microbes to decompose. You would probably have to bury it to get it to decompose. The human body does not have enough microbes to break down this product. You can rest assured that your biopolymer shirt would not fall apart, not even on a hot day. So what we have here is methane-eating bacteria. a negative emission technology with a useful byproduct. This is great. I want to know how much we can scale this up. Can we order a few million fermenters of this bacteria and put them everywhere there's methane and take greenhouse gases out of the atmosphere or prevent them from getting it into the atmosphere?
Yeah, we need to set it loose on the tundra before the tundra belches up all that methane.
Yeah, put them up in the tundra. I don't want any listeners to get carried away. This hasn't been proven at scale, so we haven't solved the climate crisis here. We still have to cut our emissions. But all the same, negative emissions technology is gold, and we should be thinking big with it.
Yes, we should. Thank you so much for your pledges during this show. And if you haven't pledged yet, go to WBAI.org, click on ways to donate and support WBAI's crucial climate program. And we can learn about, you know, methane eating bacteria, which is fantastic. For $25, you can become a member of the station and support community radio. Anyway, thank you for your support, for listening to WBAI's Extinction Rebellion Radio. We'll see you next week.
This has been Extinction Rebellion Radio.
Tune to Out FM on Tuesday, March 30th at 8 p.m. for a report on the attack on LGBT refugees in the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya.
It's a fight for us to get water. When it comes to food, we are being discriminated.
And on horrific attacks.
And possibly the worst kind, like we have seen three incidents of people being burnt, situations of lesbians being raped inside the camp. And the worst part of all is that the authorities, the UN agency in charge of refugees, as well as the Kenyan government, often throwing a blind eye against the atrocities that are happening.
Also, an interview with Pauline Park on anti-Asian violence and LGBT rights under Biden. Tune to Out FM, Tuesday, March 30th at 8 p.m. on WBAI New York.
Hey, WBAI listeners and supporters. Tune in Wednesday, March 31st from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. for the second report of 2021 from the WBAI Local Station Board. This month, you'll hear from various members of the board. They'll talk about their responsibilities, recent developments throughout the network, and they'll ask you for your ideas on how to build a stronger WBAI. Please keep in mind, this is your chance to interact with the board members on the show, so don't let this opportunity pass you by. Be sure to tune in. Again, that's Wednesday, March 31st, 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. for the second report of 2021 from the WBAI Local Station Board. Only on WBAI in New York, 99.5 FM.
Oh! Why, it's Little Red Riding Hood. Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood. You sure are looking good. You're everything a big bad wolf could want. Listen to me.
Hello, my fierce and beautiful people. I'm Johanna Fernandez, host of WBAI's morning show, A New Day. One of our listeners donated in the name of Little Red Riding Hood recently. That's because here at WBAI, the wolf is nipping at our heels. We are truly listener-sponsored non-commercial radio. We are depending on you to keep the wolf at bay and the station operating. So here's the thing. We'd love to have you donate in the name of Red Riding Hood. That's the Little Red Riding Hood plan for $25. And you'll get a full year's membership in this 60-year experiment in community radio. You know the drill. 516-620-3602. 516-620-3602. Or go to give the number 2WBAI.org. Give the number 2WBAI.org and say your Little Red Riding Hood determined to keep the wolf at bay.
previous program was Extinction Rebellion, heard Tuesdays at 6:30 p.m. right after the